This is why I'm so optimistic about our future. All you have to do is listen to Malia for 2 minutes, and I'm like, that's it. She's the future. This is how we're gonna make a difference in the world.
Welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm wondering about the relationship between Finding Nemo, field trips, and saving planet Earth. To put it another way, I'm wondering how we become captivated by an idea and what makes us change our whole lives to pursue it. My thought partners are Malia Honda, who just finished her freshman year at Brown, and Claudia Benitez-Nelson, who is an oceanographer and science mom. They are both big fans of Nemo and huge movers in the world of climate correction. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states and situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm talking to a freshman at Brown who likes water polo and environmental science. She grew up in Arizona and then Hawaii, a combination that planted a few big questions in her head. I'll also talk to a delightful oceanographer who lives part of her life out at sea, trying to figure out the fastest way to keep the oceans from changing so much that we can't live here anymore. Hey, Malia.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. So you went all the way from Hawaii to Rhode Island for college, and you just finished your first year. How was it?
It's been pretty amazing. It was definitely hard in the beginning, but I think I've got amazing friends now, and the classes and professors are just absolutely amazing. So,
how'd you hold up in the snow?
The snow was a big adjustment, especially just the first blizzard. But I think, I mean, after a while, it starts to go away. So it's pretty nice.
How many inches did you get in your first big blizzard?
I think it was around 22 inches. So definitely a once in a blue moon type of blizzard.
But and that was the first time you ever saw snow?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was kind of crazy, but...
So you have two totally different experiences in your background. You spent time in Arizona, and then around middle school, you moved to the Big Island in Hawaii. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I was around 11, my family decided to move to Hawaii. My dad is from Hawaii, so we've got lots of family there, as well as being native Hawaiian. So that was kind of a big switch, especially when you move from like such a really cultivated place where kind of all of the lawns are manicured and like nature is very unnatural there.
Yes.
To move somewhere where nature is so unbound and like living to its full potential, something like that, which is so, it doesn't even seem like it's in this world truly sometimes.
That's really well said. And so was that where your initial interest in the climate and how it's changing began?
Yeah, I think kind of just seeing how much like nature can be this amazing and wonderful thing, especially in the oceans where it's so unknown, just to see kind of that wildness of it, that aspect in itself is really magical.
And what was the first time you were aware that there was such a thing to be in the world as a climate scientist or a marine biologist?
Well, I was actually able to go on a trip to another island, a neighbor island, and kind of see marine biologists, see like politicians all fighting for like climate justice. And in that aspect, especially at like such a young age, I think I was 12 or 13, To see that firsthand and like see people actually making that change in their everyday lives, it was really amazing. And then I was able to kind of talk about what I saw with like my peers to my community once we got back, and having that impact on my own community as such a young person really like brought me to the idea that this is something I can do. This is something I can fight for. And that was a really amazing and eye-opening experience.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I think, for a young person to leave the classroom and leave the civics book and get some sense of how legislation is made and who's making it and what are the influences going into the exact language on the paper.
Yeah. I mean, that in itself is just like to see kind of the state house and see that legislation was being made. And it was about sunscreen laws and like how they were wanting to change those, which is something that went into effect 2 or 3 years ago. So like looking back now and seeing, oh, the change that I saw like being pushed was actually made and enacted.
And what was the law about sunscreen?
I can't say its exact words, but just the fact that oxybenzone not be sold in sunscreens, those chemicals bleach and kill coral. And coral is such an important part of the marine ecosystem that seeing high legislation being made in order to protect it is something that's super, super important.
So now in Hawaii, you can't use certain sunscreens like that. They have to be sort of reef safe. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So people still bring the other ones in, especially if it's tourists who might not necessarily know that that law exists. But from a vast majority of the local population, those sunscreens just are kind of obsolete and no longer used.
That's so great. It's so great for you to have caught that moment in Hawaiian legislative history.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah, it's such an impactful one, and not necessarily like a big way, which is truly how we have begun to go back on our human impact on climate change.
Yeah, no, I know. And it's just this huge series of iterations on laws and behaviors and culture that will sort of start to turn the tide. As soon as it's sort of everywhere you look, that's how people start to make the change. And I personally, until 3 seconds ago, I did not ever know that some sunscreen or that the great majority of sunscreen was hurting the coral reefs. So thanks for teaching me, which goes to this other really cool idea, which is that every generation teaches the generation that came before new ways of thinking and perceiving. And I feel like with climate, you guys are the ones who are saying, why would you get bottled water? Like, just get a little thermos and you can use it for 10 years. And why are we eating meat 3 times a week? Like, let's just eat it once a month.
Yeah, I think that intergenerational piece really speaks on how impactful a younger generation can be, especially when it comes to climate change, because we're seeing such a big change. We, as a generation, are witnessing it, are wanting to go into these professions and fight for what we're seeing, just kind of teaching our elders and our parents what we've experienced.
Yeah, I saw somewhere that 82% of your generation expects climate to change where they live and whether they have children, and that 77% of your generation feels personally responsible to do something about it. Does that resonate?
Yeah, I think it really does, especially when we're fed so much of the negative aspect of it. And I mean, it is a very, very negative thing, but to kind of look at those numbers and see a vast majority are wanting to make that change, and a vast majority are acknowledging it and pushing for it to be better, so that like the generations that follow don't have to like kind of see this failing world, this like that's kind of falling apart, but see that we're making it better and we're actively trying to make it a better place to live and a healthier and greener world is just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a cool thing about your school going to the trouble of taking you to a neighbor island and then letting you guys speak en masse to your own hometown, is that the more people that you see and can feel that are on the team that's fighting for change, that's very sustaining. I mean, that'll keep you coming back. It's hard when you feel like you're the only one. And I think that's this weird thing about climate, which is that more and more, if you ask people, if you survey people, a huge majority of people are concerned about it. But then you say, do you ever talk about it? And they say, not that much. And you say, why? And they say, I'm afraid. I'm afraid it's going to start a fight. But that what they don't know is that everybody, more or less, the great majority of people feel the same way. And so it won't start a fight.
I think just bringing it up within the community, within people you know, people you might not even know very well, just kind of bringing it to everyone's attention that there are groups that want to make this change. It's not like an, I guess that's something that's bad, but there's plenty of the population, especially in our youth, that really want to drive that change and they want to be a part of it and see it.
Yeah. I saw this quote that only 26% of people say they've been personally encouraged to take climate action by a friend or a family member. And then I think about you guys and this great generation, and I think everybody who's making legislation in Washington, D.C. and around the world, and everybody who's making corporate policy has children. And those children have influence over their parents. Like, I think that's one of the biggest levers we have.
Yeah, that communication in itself, especially from people you're close to, people you love, just it makes it so much more impactful. I know. I mean, I've definitely had experiences with this, not my parents, but like with my grandparents who didn't necessarily believe everything I was saying, but just the fact that I had brought it up made them reconsider and made them want to like have better communication within their peers and to encourage them to listen to their grandchildren and just kind of get that news out there is a really important way to just reframe thinking and like kind of understand someone who might not think the same.
Yeah. So your big move after you got a taste of what people are doing in the space was to work with sea turtles and try to understand how their migration might be changing or might be affected by changing temperatures.
Yeah, sea turtles are very, very reliant on temperatures on land because the temperature of the sand that their eggs are in will affect the sex of the turtles.
Wow.
So if there are too many of a certain sex, it's obviously going to affect the populations that follow. So there's too many males, not enough females are laying eggs, like things like that. So with changing temperatures, they're affected in a way that makes it much more obvious that our temperatures are drastically changing. And I think looking at their migratory patterns, because it also, the temperature of the waters might affect the way their prey moves. So they might not be able to go back to certain beaches, especially since turtles are so reliant on going back to the beach they were born to lay their eggs. Just these little changes are going to affect major populations. And when you look at climate change as a whole, people may not assume that a tiny change in temperature that like you might not even notice can actually affect populations of other animals, and other animals are going to affect the rest of the world as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just need that data, because if there are folks like your grandparents who are good enough to share their true doubts with you, then you need the stats, you need the facts. And I know from talking to Melinda Gates that everything starts with data. All change begins with data, because there's some set of people that will only be persuaded by real numbers. And so you're tagging sea turtles. I want to understand how a person tags a sea turtle. Like, how do you get them? Where do you put it? What are you putting in them?
So when you tag a sea turtle, you have to first catch them, which is kind of a crazy thing to imagine. But it's always with the help of a scientist, an onlooking scientist, which makes it legal. So we make sure we're only touching them for science. But you have to catch them and put a little shot almost in their back right dorsal flipper so that it can go through and you can scan it every time you catch them again, just to make sure they're returning to the beaches, if they're moving and you catch them in a different region, just kind of seeing where they've been, where they're going. And we've also been putting satellite tags on them in more recent years, I want to say over the past 4 or so, which can bounce off satellites in space and you can see where they're going through the ocean. Even if they're nowhere near land, you'll be able to see where they're swimming, where they're traveling, and see if they're following different trends than they would have when the waters were colder.
This is so amazing. I mean, when I was your age, when I was in high school, like my big outings were to go to the King of Prussia Mall and see if I could find a pair of Guess jeans on sale. Like I was not thinking about the world. I was not engaging at this level. I wasn't considering like these macro global issues. It's incredible to be exposed to you guys, the people that are in this fight, and it's really inspiring. So I want to take you quickly through the speed round. What was your favorite high school class?
Probably AP Environmental Science.
Yeah, I feel like it's everybody's. I mean, even my kids loved it. First concert?
The Wiggles.
Oh my God. Go-to comfort food?
Pasta, for sure.
So I was a pasta person too. I was butter and salt. Are you butter and salt?
No, I'm more of a homemade tomato sauce from my mom with like my grandpa's homegrown tomatoes.
Oh, that's so good. Celebrity you'd most like to meet?
Probably Jack Johnson.
Oh yeah, because he's huge in the oceans, right? Mm-hmm. And he's Hawaiian.
I can't remember if he's native, but he is from Hawaii, yeah.
Most satisfying achievement to date?
Probably just getting into college is a pretty big one.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. A sport you love to watch or play?
Water polo for both.
Oh, that's cool. Do you play at Brown?
I do, yeah.
What's your position?
I'm a utility, so I can kind of go wherever, but mostly just attacking.
Right on. If you could make one rule everyone in the world would have to follow, what would it be?
Use reef-safe sunscreen.
Mm-hmm. Because that's that's not legislated in the United States, in the continental United States, just in Hawaii.
Mm-mm, not as a whole. So it would be something that's so little of a change and impacting individuals, but on a large scale, it's so important.
Yeah. Would you say, looking back, that you had an aha moment?
I think when I was able to go to that neighbor island and kind of just see that change being made in front of me. Going to labs, going to the state house and looking at legislation, and then coming back and reporting back to my community. I think that's really important that the community was listening to its youth.
Yeah, I had written down that climate change perceptions in children seem less susceptible to the influence of worldview or political context. And so that makes it possible for you guys to inspire adults towards higher levels of climate concern and then collective action, so that this child-to-parent intergenerational learning, which is the transfer of knowledge, attitudes, or behaviors from children to parents, may be a promising pathway to overcoming all the other barriers to climate concern.
When you're looking at something like climate change in the eyes of like a 10-year-old, you're like, why aren't we making the waters cleaner? Like, you make me clean my room all the time. Like, why shouldn't the world be clean? Like that type of just youthful innocence in a way, it makes it easier to like understand the world and just to like see it kind of in those eyes. It makes older generations just like reconsider it a little bit, which makes it so much easier to understand.
I mean, just looking at a 10-year-old and thinking, well, if you live to be 100, what will the world look like 90 years from now? Like as soon as it's within someone you love's lifespan, then it matters in a new way. It's just less abstract.
I think this generation kind of being able to see that change firsthand and seeing that like on our current track, if we don't change something, the world for our generation, as we get older, the next generations, it won't be beautiful. People will not experience the same world that we are right now.
Yeah.
And that kind of, that aspect of it really just encourages my generation at least to enact some sort of change in any way we can.
How many turtles can a girl like you tag in a day?
It's definitely, it takes a little bit of a team, but I think 10 to 20, probably.
Okay. And do you fall a little bit in love with every turtle you tag?
A lot of times, they're not as nice as it may seem. They kind of flap around a lot. I mean, it's kind of like when you go to the doctor and get a shot, like you're not typically wanting to sit down in that chair,
right.
But it's important that you do. So
I see. Not like Crush from Finding Nemo.
Sometimes they can be like that, but most of the time they're not. So if we find a crush, then we're pretty happy. But most of the time they're not as satisfied to be in that chair.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried anything that's been a real bust that you thought, oh, I wish I could do that again. I'd do it differently.
I think that the communication aspect is really what's been the biggest bust, because when you make science sound too sciencey, I think it's off-putting to some people that may just not understand it in those terms. If you're trying to get information out there just in a scientific research paper, like it may not be as effective as if you're just having a conversation with someone.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely try and make it more conversational instead of just kind of putting the facts out there. It makes it seem much more accessible.
Yeah. Another enemy of progress, I think, is perfectionism.
Yeah.
Like putting
definitely.
Out these ideas that you're a hypocrite if you say you care about the environment, but you've ever eaten a hamburger. Or
yeah.
you fly to see your grandma, and so you must not really care. Like that's just an unsustainable expectation that everybody's going to live this clean, fully realized climate citizen of the world reality.
Yeah, I think the aspect that like people may assume that climate justice is about perfectionism is almost entirely incorrect, because there are so many little steps that you can take or that anyone can take in order to just do any sort of impact. Like maybe walking instead of taking your car, or riding a bike instead of taking your car, using like kind of what I said with reef safe sunscreen instead of chemical sunscreen, or taking a reusable water bottle, a reusable bag, just kind of those little steps, just get it out there that like, this is such a simple solution to such a large problem that small change can kind of domino effect and lead to a much larger change on a big scale.
And also it's contagious. I mean, the peer pressure is a real thing. And if everybody I know brings their own bags to the grocery store, I'm going to start bringing my bags to the grocery store. And what that means is that everybody in the grocery store is going to be getting this casual social reinforcement that like, this is what we do now. And the more of that is evident to more people, the higher the likelihood is, I think, that we pass legislation and that we change corporate policy in those places where there's just terrible damage being done through carbon emissions. Like if you're a legislator and you walk through your supermarket and every single person in there has their cloth bags, you're going to think, this is starting to matter to people. Voters are starting to care about this. Maybe I need to address this in the debate. Maybe I need to address this in my campaign materials. And maybe I need to pass some legislation to reduce carbon emissions.
Exactly. That kind of community aspect of it, just looking and seeing what everyone around you is doing definitely drives a lot more encouragement than some may think.
Yes, and the finger wagging is nothing compared to the influence of observing it everywhere you look, all these signs that everyone cares now.
I think that's really evident within youth as well, especially through things like social media, just that type of encouragement, looking at like influencers who may be doing the same thing all around, just like makes you reconsider what you're doing and maybe why.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best uses of celebrity and social media that I can think of. Is like Leonardo DiCaprio, I think, is like a model in this way, is that he's using his platform to remind people every day. And if that has some outsized influence because we're a culture that kind of hangs on celebrity, great. Like, let's use it to our advantage to make change.
Exactly, yeah.
So Malia, you're an inspiration. I'll never think about sea turtles quite the same way as long as I live. And I wish you great luck at Brown. And thanks a lot for keeping us honest.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just happy to be able to kind of bring more attention to it. So it's so great. Thank you.
You bet. Coming up next, I'll be talking with oceanographer, professor, and science mom, Dr. Claudia Benitez Nelson. This episode was funded by the great people at the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. You can learn more about this fantastic organization at avdf.org. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan. After I spoke with Malia, I talked to Dr. Claudia Benitez Nelson. She's an associate dean and the Carolina Distinguished Professor in the College of Arts and Science at the University of South Carolina. She's also a science mom. Hello, how are you? Thanks a lot for saying yes.
Oh, good morning. It's my pleasure.
So you had a chance to listen to Malia.
Oh, my goodness. She is so amazing. And this is why I'm so optimistic about our future. All you have to do is listen to Malia for 2 minutes. And I'm like, that's it. She's the future. This is how we're going to make a difference in the world.
Yeah. You know, I was kind of backwards designing her enthusiasm. Like I was trying to figure out where did it start and where did it come from? And I thought about how impactful that little trip was to another island to watch a little piece of legislation about sunblock get debated and passed.
I mean, that to me really shows the importance of bringing your kids or allowing your children to be involved in things that perhaps we would normally say, well, that's politics, that's boring. But no, right? I mean, she went over there, listened to what the politicians and what the local communities were saying about climate and climate justice. And that has really influenced her whole short, she's young, but career path, right, in terms of what she wants to do and climate action. I guess we all kind of have that moment, right, that really triggers us into what that passion will be.
Well, I definitely wanted to flag it because for anybody out there who has any influence over school field trips, they're worth it. Like, you could create a climate warrior with one trip. So don't cut those budgets. Don't let them get cut on you. Volunteer to go along to keep the costs low. Make sure that the kids are like heads up, eyes open, taking it in. Like that, these opportunities for exposure are critical junctures in the process.
Oh, so absolutely agree. And I understand some of the budget constraints that happen. But at the same time, I mean, look how amazingly impactful this was for her. And I'm sure it wasn't just for her. I'm sure it was for the entire group, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in any number of ways, like just understanding how the sausage gets made with legislation and how much work it is to pass even a smallish local law about sunblock, like to see a win, a legislative win in a world with the headlines that are telling us day in and day out that nothing is getting done and that it's all intractable. It's not true. It's not intractable. Like, things get done. Things are happening at the local level that have impact. And to be totally honest, as I confessed to Malia, I didn't even know that there was a problem with some sunblocks and their impact on the coral reef. I'm sure you did.
Well, I did, but I do want to go back to this idea that you can see change happening. You can see the success of what seems to be a very small or innocuous law and the impact that it will actually have on the ecosystem of Hawaii. I mean, this is incredible, right? It's like you see someone else do it, you see that it's possible, and then all of a sudden you're, well, I can do that too. And you cannot dismiss that, right? I mean, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, early days when they said women couldn't run a marathon, right? Or we'd never go to the moon. And here it is. You see someone else doing it and you're like, you know, I can do that. I mm-hmm. can make a change. And she is, you know, so smart and leading out to be like, I saw the change and I can make a change. And here are the things that I am doing. So, I mean, that's 100%, I think, where it needs to go. And good for her to take that experience and then be the leader to show others that it can be done too. But yeah, we could talk about that sunscreen. These are two kind of compounds that it turns out make a fundamental difference in coral bleaching. It damages their DNA. And simply by using other types of sunscreens, Hawaii is moving forward, not just to protect their environment and sustainability, which is the right thing to do, but is also forward thinking about tourism. You know, everyone goes to Hawaii. What do you want to do? You want to go snorkeling and see the coral reefs at Hanama Bay or Molokini. And this is good for them.
Yeah. And whenever there's a win-win-win, like good for the planet, good for tourism, good for the bottom line, like all those things converging is where we'll get the fastest, easiest action. Did you have a moment like Malia's where you were turned on?
I think for me, it was really being with my mom. And my mom, who, let's be honest, she grew up in New York City and then moved over to Seattle and wanted to start a garden for the first time. It was quite the experience. And I remember being relatively young and working with my mom, trying to start that first garden. And, you know, how do we plant the seeds and how do we water them? And I think that really made me recognize and appreciate where food comes from and just being around the land. And then, of course, being near the ocean and the importance of the ocean. We'd go hiking, we'd go crabbing, we'd always be out on the water. And I think it's just kind of that prolonged experience and exposure that just fundamentally impacted where I am now.
You know, it makes you wonder if in the course of time when everyone was tied to the land, that everyone was a farmer at one point, and then we urbanized and then people got further and further away from sort of daily intakes of nature, and then the whole idea maybe becomes more abstract. Like it you know, to a farmer, that they're never unaware of the weather and the weather's impacts. They're living and dying by the weather. But to, you know, city folk who are hopping on and off a subway and are just in the concrete jungle, it could be easier to forget that it's a natural world that we are beholden to.
Oh, I agree. That's why, again, I think it's so important to come back full circle for everyone to have opportunities to experience these type of field trips out of the classroom and experiencing the land, the ocean, the environment around us, and feeling, you know, the waves beneath your feet or looking at the soil or playing in the sand. I mean, you see this, you experience it, and you appreciate it. And then you understand why it's so important that we have to preserve and protect it for our future.
When did you get serious about a life in science?
Well, I'll be honest, for me, I've always enjoyed science. It's something that I've always been good at. I'm not sure I loved it necessarily when I was in high school, but it was just something that came relatively easy to me.
That's so funny that you say that. I once said about my daughter in front of her to a friend, Georgia loves science. And later she said to me, I just want to tell you, I don't actually love science. I'm just good at it.
100%. Me and your daughter. For me, I was in college and I was majoring in chemistry because I was good at it, not because I was passionate about it. And I ended up taking an oceanography class. And this to me was transformational. I was taking an oceanography class because I thought it would be an easy class. It fit into my schedule. I needed it because I had soccer practice in the afternoon. And I thought, oh, it's going to be all whales and dolphins, which is cool, but, you know, maybe not something I really wanted to do all the work in. And I had this fantastic professor, and it was like, this is how the Earth works. This is why we have the oceans and they move the way they do. This is why we have seasons. This is why the plants and the animals that live in the ocean live in all these very specific places, and this is how they thrive. And he pulled me aside and was like, have you thought about the oceans as a career path? And, you know, me at the time, this was many, many decades ago, I was like, well, no. I mean, is this a place
soccer
that I could get a job at? Yeah, I was playing soccer, right? I was 20, 19, right? And he was like, no, I think you'd really enjoy it. And he and an academic advisor helped me find a lab to go work in and just test it out. And that was it. I was converted. And all of a sudden, I was taking courses in oceanography and chemistry. And it was a life-changing event because the class was the only open class in the afternoon that fit in my schedule. Who knew?
Right? So tell me about the work you do now.
Right now, a lot of the work that I am doing, in addition to kind of the research and going out to sea and collecting, you know, samples, is I am the current chair of the Ocean Studies Board, and I am working with this group of incredibly intelligent, diverse individuals from industry, from private foundations, from academia, from federal agencies, to really think about where we see ourselves as a field and how are we going to engage everyone on the table to really think about, you know, our future and the Earth that we want moving forward. I mean, I think that is a wonderful fundamental thing that I'm thinking about a lot, and thinking about how Science Moms, which is another group that I am very engaged in, and it's talking about parents and how do we engage not just those who happen to be oceanographers, right? But, you know, my friends, people who, you know, our kids are in music camp together, you know, to get them really thinking about how we impact our environment and what are all the things that we can do, getting a little bit outside of our comfort zone, to really make a difference moving forward.
So when you get out on the ocean, how long are you out there and what do you see and what kind of thoughts are running through that head of yours?
Oh, I love going to sea. So I'm what's called a blue water oceanographer. So that means that I literally go to a port and I get out on a ship and I will be out at sea sometimes for 4 to 6 weeks or even longer. And this is a opportunity for me to really work with a group of incredibly intelligent and fun and exciting individuals who were all there focused on one goal, and that is to better understand our oceans. And there's technicians, and there's graduate students, and then there's the crew of this ship. So we really become a family, and we work really hard in terms of putting instruments over the side and collecting our samples to really try and better understand how carbon dioxide makes its way into the oceans and the various organisms and phytoplankton that live in the ocean and are growing and are feeding and are supporting the larger fisheries and animals that are out there. I mean, it's wonderful. I just love it.
How many trips have you taken like that? And what does your family do when you're gone? Like, do they just eat cereal for dinner? Or are they getting pretty good at, like, making square meals and such?
Well, I do take a lot of trips. When my kids were younger, I really transitioned to doing much shorter trips. So I would be gone for maybe 3 or 4 days. Or I would have my students go out and they would go out to sea, which was never a burden on them. But my kids, they really have always thought that what I do is exciting and wonderful. We have made a point that they would come and join me. So in opportunities where I would come back to port or I would be maybe doing some work coastally, they would come. And so they've gotten to go to like South Africa and Madagascar and England and Spain. And, you know, we just put them in the backpack and we just go.
So when you're collecting samples, what have you been discovering? I mean, you've been doing this for a couple decades now. Like, what is the data showing?
Well, we're seeing a lot of changes in our ocean. Sometimes when you look at the ocean, you think it's all the same, right? It's blue, it's big, it's deep. Well, our oceans have very different biomes, just like we do on land. There's, you know, the mountain areas, there's the tropical areas, and these are the same types of biomes that we have out in our oceans. And so we can really start to see, and we're starting to understand, that warming of the surface waters is fundamentally changing the communities that are living in the various parts of the ocean. By putting this carbon dioxide, this fossil fuel pollution, into the atmosphere, it is essentially acidifying our oceans. And so that has having fundamental changes into the types of communities that are living there. It's changing how our oceans circulate. Who would have thought, right? I mean, our whole ocean currents and circulation patterns are starting to alter. And what that's doing is it's influencing how nutrients make their way into the surface ocean. And let's be honest, if you're an organism, you need food. You need food. And if your food isn't there and it's hot, it changes the whole ecosystem and then how material makes its way from the surface down into the deep ocean and affects all those organisms that live down deep. So, yeah, I mean, it's been very interesting for me to really see how these changes have evolved and to fundamentally understand that that's due to us. I mean, this isn't natural climate variability. We're seeing extremes that we have never seen from what we can understand from our geologic past. I mean, it's us.
Yeah. Yeah. This may seem kind of simple-minded, so forgive me. But I'm thinking about Finding Nemo. It was the first movie that my daughter, Georgia, ever saw in a movie theater. And we had to take her out during the Bruce scenes, you know, the giant shark.
Yeah.
Bruce.
And then we bring her back in. But there's some magic in there in terms of showing the East Australian current and Crush.
Crush.
You know, the sea turtle.
I teach intro oceanography, and I tell everyone to watch Finding Nemo. And there's really good oceanography in there. And I'm like, tell me what you've learned in class that totally, you know, links up with what you saw in Finding Nemo. They all love it. It's fantastic. Yeah.
So I think about all the ways that we might persuade the world to take it all more seriously and demand change from corporations in particular who are, you know, largely responsible. Is storytelling, really effective storytelling. And Pixar's been so responsible, as you say, with looping in oceanographers to make sure that whatever they're putting on the screen is fundamentally accurate. And to personalize the East Australian Current with this hilarious sea turtle, this kind of Spicoli of sea turtles, is actually really just another little nudge in the right direction.
Oh, I agree. EAC, man. Yeah, that's the I and my students who all kind of grew up with Finding Nemo. I mean, they know the currents. They're like, oh yeah, I remember watching that, and how the turtles hitch a ride on those currents to kind of get to where they're going. And I'm like, yep. That's why how the ocean moves is important. It's that little, you know, tram, that little escalator that just goes whoop, and you hitch a ride.
And that's changing.
Yeah, and that's changing. And that's not only is that changing, but as Malia is studying, and I'm so excited about this, understanding that the temperature of the sand can completely influence if a turtle's egg is going to be male or female.
I couldn't believe it. I didn't know that.
Who knew? And can we just talk about, we're not talking huge temperatures here. We're talking like 88 degrees Fahrenheit. It's going to be 95 degrees outside in South Carolina today. 88 degrees Fahrenheit. If it gets that much hotter in sand, your turtles are going to be female. There it is. That's it. There's the data. The nests are not as successful. The mortality rate is a lot higher. And if it's colder than 82 degrees, they're all male, right? So it seems silly, right? 82 to 88, right? That's kind of your sweet spot where you get a nice mix. And so just to increase temperatures in our planet, they're like, what's 1 degree? What's 2 degrees? What's 3 degrees? I'm like, no, that's a big deal.
Yeah. Right, because if it's influencing the sea turtle population, I'm sure that's one of 100 things that get bumped around when the degrees change by 1 or 2.
It's one of thousands of things. I mean, if you think about it, our Earth is like the human body. Our human bodies are so complex, and we know that our body temperatures work perfectly around 98, 97, 98 degrees. Right? When you take your temperature, like that's the sweet spot. But if you're above 99, get closer to 100, we have fevers. We're sick. I mean, so is it really so surprising that a few degrees on our planet make such an impact? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's a great metaphor because it's understandable that people would minimize the difference or dismiss the potential impacts, because it's so vast. The thing that we're talking about is so inconceivably vast. And so it really is a job for metaphor. It is incumbent on the people who care, which hopefully will tip into everyone eventually. I mean, a lot of people care right now, and more people will care every day. But for all of us who are trying to expand the army and make the demands louder and more impactful, it's language we need. It's images. It's every communication tool available to us. So it's everything from Pixar to your metaphor about the human body that needs to be brought to bear. In the end, it becomes this challenge of communication. And that's at some level what we have here.
Yes.
Is if 70% of the people care about it, but 20% of the people are talking about it and 5% of the people are doing something about it, like how do you move those numbers?
I think it's all about example, and it's all about overcoming that fear and that concern that you are talking to some individuals who don't necessarily agree with you. I think that is the one thing that we forget, in that if you look at every study, every conversation, we all agree that climate change is happening and that we are influencing our planet in bad ways, and that we need to think about how we change the dynamic and we make things better, right?
Yeah. I'm taking you through the speed round. Are you ready?
Oh, okay. Yes.
Favorite high school class?
Oh, science. Easy.
First concert?
The Grateful Dead with my parents.
No.
Yes. Seattle.
With your parents?
Yeah. They took me. I must have been like 10 years old. Yep.
Are they hippies?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What's your go-to comfort food?
Grapes.
Oh, that's a good one. Most satisfying achievement to date?
Oh, well, I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. I would say it's my husband and raising two outstanding kids. My daughter just turned 18, so this has really been on my mind, thinking about my kids and what they're doing. And I've got to tell you, I'm so proud of them. I really am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sport you love to watch or play?
Oh, I think soccer. Come on. You knew that was going to be the answer.
Favorite just for fun app?
Oh, Spotify.
Opening guess in Wordle?
Oh, ocean.
Oh, you're so on point.
Ocean.
You could make one rule that everyone in the world would have to follow, what would it be?
They have to be kind.
Right on. Sure would fix a lot of things.
I think so.
I love talking to you.
I very much enjoyed chatting with you, and thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to listen to all the really cool stuff that Malia is doing. It was so inspiring to just hear her talk. I mean, this is it. Like, she's our future, and I just want her to be successful.
Thanks again. And everybody, the move for today is to sign up for the email list at sciencemoms.com. All right, off you go. Back to the ocean.
Thanks, I've enjoyed it.
Here are my takeaways from talking to Malia Honda and Dr. Claudia Benitez-Nelson. Number one, living in Hawaii for a stint will make you really love and respect nature. Number two, keep it conversational. Be careful not to make science sound too sciencey. Number three, some things require a field trip. Number four, legislation is incremental, one sunscreen ingredient at a time. Number five, every generation teaches the generation that came before how to be better. Number six, be not afraid. A vast majority of us are eager to make change. Number seven, hot sand ruins sea turtle eggs. Number eight, finger wagging is far inferior to being the example. Number nine, the earth is not unlike a human body. 1 or 2 degrees warmer can and do create system-wide problems. And number 10, it is not intractable. Things get done. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, the one thing we'd like to ask you to do is to go to sciencemoms.com and sign up for their newsletter. That's it. It's free. It's simple. But it's a way to engage in the content and keep learning, to be available as opportunities for conversation and activism present themselves. I want to thank Malia Honda and Claudia Benitez-Nelson. I'd also like to thank my friends at Potential Energy Coalition, whose help and advice has been invaluable to this series. That's John Marshall, Anne Marie Klein, Haley Rovner, and Katie Butler. I'd also like to thank the Science Moms and climate advisors Kevin Green, Jack Joe, and Tony Lizarowitz. Special thanks go to the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations for their generous support of this series. Finally, I'd like to thank the team at Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's technical producer Dean Kateri and executive producer Tammy Stedman. We'll be back Friday with another For the Good of the Order, and on Sunday with a new Thanks for Being Here.